Shrink Wrap Radio number 581, Polishing the Bones, with Jungian analyst Penelope Tarasuk, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst and author Penelope Tarasuk, PhD. We'll be discussing her remarkable book, Polishing the Bones, which is a longitudinal case account of a Jungian analysis over the course of 7 years. For more information about Jungian analyst Penelope Tarasuk, PhD, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Penelope Tarasuk, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's great to be here, Dr. Dave. Would you rather me call you Dave or
Dr. Dave? Whatever you're comfortable with. Dr. Dave is a little, what do you call it? It's for the show, and ordinarily I don't ask to be doctored.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm really so glad to have you on the show. Because I read your book, which is Polishing the Bones, and what a powerful and wonderful book it is. I'm going to strongly endorse it for all of my listeners. Yeah, and I love the title of the book, Polishing the Bones, was just somehow so right. And I assumed that it was a quote from Shakespeare or somebody like that, only to discover when I finally got near the end of the book that it actually comes from one of your client's dreams. And it was just the perfect title for the whole journey that you had. And as you say in the introduction, your book is the story of a long and deep psychological treatment that you undertook with a middle-aged woman whom, for the purposes of the book, you call Laura. And you worked with her over the course of 7 years. And from one point of view, the book might be considered a longitudinal study of Jungian analysis. And I don't think I've previously run across such an extended and in-depth account of a Jungian analysis with a single patient. Is it unique in that respect?
I don't think there are many. I think June Singer wrote Boundaries of the Soul.
I love that book. Yeah.
And Robbie Bosnack wrote a book called Christopher's Dreams based on working with an AIDS patient. But I don't think there's been anything quite like this.
I don't think so. And I've read June Singer's book, and I don't recall a single case that runs through it. I could be wrong, but I taught out of that book for many years.
Oh, good. Well, you know, Dave, Dr. Dave, I wanted to do many things. One is I wanted to invite people into what Jungian work can be like, because many people won't actually go through a Jungian analysis, but they might be curious and they might want a taste of depth work. So I bring them really right into me to take this journey with me.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really treasure about this book is that it's something that can be appreciated both by an absolute novice who's just curious to find, well, what is this Jungian stuff about? All the way to somebody who's, you know, an analyst themselves.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think it can really covers the waterfront in an amazing way.
Thank you.
So dream work is at the core of much of your work with Laura, and I guess in your work generally. And she seemed to arrive at your door really ready to. Let me just back up. I skipped ahead a little bit. there's no way that we can cover the entire story here in the hour that we're going to have together. And I really wrestled with, my goodness, how am I going to do this interview? But I think it came to me, and we'll see at the end if you agree. So there's no way that we can cover the entire story, but maybe you can kind of frame it for us a bit and give us the setup for it.
Well, the setup was, a woman called me one afternoon asking to start work with me, and she seemed quite determined to do the work, and she seemed determined to see me. She received a referral, and I would say she was extremely ready to bloom into the work. She was motivated. She had the time and space. Anyway, we made an appointment, and as I said in the book, I told her that I would be moving to Santa Fe, you know, within a few years.
You were in Massachusetts, right?
Yes, just outside of Tufts University near Boston, yeah, which is where I trained at the C.G. Jung Institute of Boston. Anyway, she said even though I was going to move, that was fine. She wanted that, so we made an appointment, and she arrived. And she arrived really ready to work. She brought journals. She had already been practicing her own dream work. She had 1 year of college, by the way, only 1 year. She was one of the most well-read, serious students of the psyche and psychology and many, many things, art and design. It was really, so she was ready and she could do it.
And she had had some therapy previously, right?
She came to me when she was about 56. She'd had therapy at age 25 briefly when she had a mastectomy for, it was breast cancer, and she was treated for that with a radical mastectomy. And during the operation, the hospital, a very famous West Coast hospital, at that time did not screen blood properly or thoroughly and was given hepatitis B and C. So she had therapy around that time around the illness, but she had marital issues that were really coalesced into something very obvious with her husband. And so between leaving her marriage and her illness and kind of a sense of betrayal by the medical profession and, well, many things came together. And so she sought a psychiatrist and had a very good experience with a man.
So that's the therapy that she had before she came to you a number of years later, right?
Correct. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And so as I started to say before, dream work is at the core of your work. And she arrived so ready because, as you point out, she was already keeping a dream journal. I guess she was an artist and along with everything else that she was managing. Mm-hmm. She was also a mother.
She was the mother of two adult children, at this point adult, an older daughter who in her teenage years had a car accident, hit her head, and I'm sure there were many other pieces to this, but she decompensated, was very depressed, and attempted suicide at home, and was removed and treated inpatient for some time. She had attempted suicide, and basically over a period of years continued to unravel and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And remained, and probably remains, in residential treatment. There was a younger son who had to go through all this loss himself, losing a sibling that way. Anyway, so she had two grown children at that point. Yes.
Okay. So getting back to dreams, what can you tell us about your approach to dream work?
Oh,
I haven't prepped you at all for this, so you're just going to have to take the questions as they come.
All right. Well, one thing I would say is someone comes in, they often, because they know I do this work, they will either bring a dream because I've said, please bring a dream with you, preferably one you've just had, or if there's something important from before, bring it. And I would say I meet a dream much like I'm meeting a stranger, like I'm meeting you. You know, at some level, this is a dream, you know. Yep. And I'm open to what it's about. I'm paying attention to the structure of the dream, the symbols, the dreamer's language, their position, their breathing, all of that. But listening really deeply and listening to how the dream affects me. And in the book, I write quite a bit about my experience that I never share with the patient at all. There's so much stuff going on in me. And I want to stay out of the way because I want to hear what they have to say. And in Jungian work, often the initial dream is quite important. It can be seen as prognostic. But, you know, it really is an adventure because it's like I'm coming into a new land and I've done this work for many, many years, you know, totally 50 as a therapist, but as a Jungian since 1988, and I have come to trust the self. I've come to trust what the self wants me to know, but also that the self is there's a self-healing capacity in all of us. And I feel very privileged to meet a new client and work on dreams. And also, I mean, in this moment, I feel privileged to have this opportunity to share with you.
Yeah. So, yeah. I get that sense of privilege, you know, reading the book. By the way, mm-hmm. I want to show a copy of, this is the book that we're talking about. Polishing the Stones, paperback, the version I have. I don't know if it's also in hardback or not.
No, I don't think it's in hardback.
Okay. Well, it should be, just so that it stands the test of time.
Let me tell you a little story about it.
Okay.
I've worked on this book for 15 years.
How many?
15 years, not including the years ahead at work with her before I started writing. Draft after draft, deeper and deeper and deeper.
I can believe it.
And I was very fortunate to find a New York literary agent, a wonderful, mature, older woman, Mary Yost, who accepted the book. And I got to go meet her and go to the Upper East Side and have literary lunches with her. Mm. That was in 2012, right when the whole digital world impacted publishing. It's a very different world now than even in 2012. Anyway, she told me she'd been the agent for Rollo May, and she had worked with the woman who wrote Three Faces of Eve and brokered that into one of the early movies about dissociation. But she was interested in women in psychiatry, and psychology, women's psychology, and wanted the book. I said, absolutely, you can have it. And she said, I want it to be hardback and I wanted it to be distributed. So this went on and we were getting ready and she had the copies to go and she had a series of strokes and was absolutely unable to go on with her work. So there was a couple of years where I was pretty, that was a real loss because it was quite a wonderful experience in the sense of the old literary world. So I, you know, started searching again. I talked to a number of agents and a couple of publishers, and they said that it's a wonderful book, but I can't sell it. And, you know, I said, okay. But then, very fortunately, I was at a Groff Transpersonal Training Module a couple of years ago, and I met Jay Dufresne, and he said, would you like to talk to my publisher, Tim Reed, of Moose Oil Hill Books? And I said, absolutely. Tim read it, and he invited me to publish. So, I mean, it's been a journey of ups and downs and meeting wonderful people, you know, so that's been a journey in itself.
Yeah.
And
I'm realizing how apt the title is, not just for Laura, but for you in this work, that the book itself was a kind of polishing of the bones.
Absolutely.
Let me, you highlighted the importance of the initial dream in Jungian analysis, and I hadn't planned on this, but I know you've got a copy of the book. Maybe you can find that first dream quickly and read it to us.
Okay.
Because you end up referring to it again a number of times throughout the book, but also at the end of the book that indeed it was a prognostic dream, and so you revisit it. But let's hear that dream.
So this is the first dream. It's actually two sets of images. 4 a.m. image, six small stones lined up, tied together on a cord. 6:30 a.m. image, a monolith partially buried in the sand or earth, large, dark, and heavy. Would you like me to share her notes on this?
Yeah, I think so. Let me just say one thing, though, is that these are just sort of like fragments that she recalls and not a whole long narrative. And it's important to underscore that sometimes it doesn't take a whole long narrative to be significant. And having taught dream work myself, that's one of the things I have to persuade people of, to not despise the little snippets that they have, that they can reclaim.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I wanted to underscore at some point here, this would be a good time, you talk about how there's a lot going on inside you, but you don't necessarily share it, at least then.
Right.
So there's something about timing, and that was something I really respected in the book, because I think I'm not always as restrained as I should be. And I want to jump in, you know, I've got, I think I know what's going on here.
Well, you know, it's a mystery, and I have learned to respect the mystery that's unfolding right in the room before us. And a word that is almost a mantra is listen. And it keeps getting deeper, of course. But, you know, when people come into treatment, including Laura, it's not, and Hillman said this, people come in not to fix what's broken, but to have what's broken blessed. And I think that is so wise. Mm-hmm. So my work is really listening at all the levels I can listen, and trusting, opening the space and building a relationship that allows the patient, the client, to unfold and find themselves. Because I do believe we have great wisdom, all of us. We just don't always know it. And I mean, yes, I have to have a personality and an ego, and I have my complexes, but I'm really it's a sacred space, and I'm holding that space and listening.
Yeah, I love that quote from Hillman. I wasn't familiar with it. Mm-hmm. Say it once again so we can all let it sink in.
Okay. People don't come into treatment to fix what's broken. They really come in to have what's broken blessed. And I may be quoting it a little bit off, but I basically, that's Jim Hillman.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. If it makes sense to share some of Laura's associations and your thoughts, go ahead.
Well, she talked about the stones on a cord as trying to arrange them in a meaningful way and make some sense out of them. And then in terms of the only rock in the landscape, she said, I think it represents what is dark and hidden and too enormous to lift. But the top is uncovered, clearly visible. is this the work that I've been doing on my own? And the stones also may represent my arrangement of hope for relief from coming to work with P or coming to work with Penelope in analysis. And we worked with all of this for a long time. But for me as an analyst to hear of someone unearthing essentially a monolith in their first dream, not their ego unearthing, but the psyche bringing this, honestly, it's probably one of the most profound first dreams I've ever heard, because it's beyond human. It's more about the elemental core of the earth and the mystery, because clearly this cord of stones and this monolith were shaped by some other force beyond the personality. So it was like glimpsing at the philosopher's stone right as the door opened. And but to really understand this and to work with the mystery of the philosopher's stone or life itself was going to take time and a relationship that was trusting and safe.
Yeah, yeah. And her dreams, as this one evidences, were a mix of personal and the archetypal.
Yes.
And maybe you can comment some on of the archetypal themes that emerged over the course of your work together over 7 years.
Well, that dream led to associations around the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, which came out in 1968, and it was very meaningful to her. And the themes within that film, which is, gosh, I guess it's a cult film by now, journey, life and death, the personal human experience and the cosmic experience, life, death, rebirth. There's also a theme in terms of working with the mechanical artificial intelligence and the human. I don't think that's resolved in the dream, but it does bring it up, which I think we're dealing with now, collectively. And let's see. And the loneliness of the astronaut, the loneliness of the spiritual seeker, the loneliness of being a human in the cosmos. Even with help and support and connection, we face the unknown when we die. So that's some of that. And the cord was, among other things, it could have been a necklace. It could have been a counting rope. It could have been symbolic of the six people that are most important to her in her life. But it was arranged by apparently something or someone human. And it was about organization and order, and it could have been about linear time, whereas the stone was more about eternal time.
And so how do you decide when to focus on the personal and when to focus on the archetypal?
I don't think there's a rule about that. I usually start from the dream and honor the symbols, and it inevitably, as someone starts talking about something, for instance, the stone took her back to 1968, and it took her back into her the inception of a relationship that led to a long marriage. You know, I mean, it just it keeps opening up. There isn't a specific order, and I don't know if all analysts do this, but I will often go back and pick up where we left off. Even a year, sometimes I'll say, remember that dream? And we go back in and we work more deeply. I think dreams are alive. I think they are part of the living psyche, and they keep yielding. The word that just came is milk. I think they keep nourishing our soul.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you can't dream, that you might fantasize, or you might have subliminal thoughts, or you might have some obsessions. So we would work with that. But some people do come in saying, you know, I don't dream, or I can't remember.
Right. Yeah.
But they often do start dreaming if I start paying close attention to them.
Yeah. It's like the inner psyche is alert to be blessed.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it will respond to that deep listening that you're doing.
Yes.
Now, to leap ahead here, sort of towards the end, at some point in the analysis, it becomes clear that that Laura is dying, and that fact kind of ends up framing this whole analysis really as a preparation for what's to come over the 7-year period, and. Again, it goes. She had so many tragedies in her life, and we're not going to go into all those here. But in the process of your caring and listening, she began to open up to all the painful areas and tragedies in her life, which were many. But one of the greatest was that sense of betrayal by the medical system that she was given bad blood, which led to her having hepatitis, which ultimately killed her at 66, which is relatively young. And so a great sense of loss and a real struggle to come to terms with all the pain in her life, all the tragedy.
You know, I think she had an extraordinary amount of challenge emotionally. And part of what was so unusual is her capacity to be curious and to keep opening and to honor the challenges, of which she had many. Just fell into a deep hole there.
Oh, that's okay. Well, she brought a lot of strength to it. And there was all this damage on the one hand, but on the other hand, she brought in extraordinary strength and courage. Is that what you're getting at?
No, what I was going to say is that I think there is so much unexperienced grief in most people. I would say the importance of the grief work takes us deeper into the self, and it takes us into that dark negredo place that many of us avoid. But it's from that depth that we find really the gold and the diamonds, but we have to be willing to go into our own suffering. And I and many other people in this field have the capacity to hold that space while people experience their losses. And from there, they reassemble and can grow.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because it really comes through in the book how you had to sit with her pain, you know, which probably triggered a lot of stuff in you as well. And to be able to sit with that is remarkable. I was very impressed by that.
Well,
how do you take care of yourself to be able to bear that?
Well, I have a very, very difficult history, which I won't go into here. But I began formal therapy when I was a teenager after a life-threatening crisis. And on and off my whole life, I have learned to seek help. And I think I say this in the beginning, I had my first experience of therapy when my father had a psychotic breakdown after he left the Navy. He had been a deep-sea diver at Pearl Harbor. And as you can imagine, the trauma of bringing up the bodies, here's the bones of the bodies again.
Yeah, wow.
And he was Russian, first generation Russian, so he had tremendous grief. Anyway, the Navy, the Veterans Administration, asked him to stay at home, and they sent a psychologist who fatefully, miraculously, turned out to be a Jungian, who happened to be a Unitarian minister. And so I would get to sit, I was between 4 and 6, I would get to sit in the living room and meet him and see him and hear some of this. and watch my father change. And he began writing and wrote fairy tales and painted. And wow. So I really began this early. I bore his psychosis, which he returned from, as everybody in the family did. But I also learned to seek help. And so I've had what I would call a ladder of angels. I've had so much help. And I have supervision. I always have a senior analytic supervisor or someone even outside the Jungian field. But we can't do this alone. I can't do it alone. I really need people who love me and people who listen to me. And I just build it in as part of my work. So I'm not bearing it all alone.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. That's a good set of reminders for us all. And what a privilege, in a way, what a privileged childhood you had to get exposed to Jungian thought and ways of, you know, viewing the world and experiencing things at such a young age.
Yes, it was a privilege, but it was also the darkest part of the privilege. You know, there was tremendous violence and suffering, but I also got great love, you know, from the same person who suffered so deeply and struck out, et cetera. Both of my parents were creative people, and both experienced tremendous loss in their lives. So I grew up around a lot of pain and suffering, but I listened to the stories. So I come by this very honestly.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah.
Well, when it became clear that Laura was not far away from dying, mm-hmm. she asked you to move in with her, mm-hmm. and with her and her husband, mm-hmm. and to be there for her passing. So what was that decision process like for you?
Well, it was very challenging. The hepatic carcinoma wrapped around her portal vein really moved things very quickly. We had never talked about what would happen. We did not anticipate this because she had lived such a healthy life outside of this virus. So we brought the analysis to a close, and she had had a dream, which I think we'll talk about. And it was the last dream we formally worked on, and we formally ended the analysis because she was going to need all her physical energy and attention to deal with her illness. And she finally did make the decision to die at home with hospice help. But after we terminated the formal work, she and her husband continued to talk, and she said she wanted me to come and help her die. He totally supported her. So she called and asked me if I would consider that. And I really didn't know what to do.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I said, give me some time to think about this. So I consulted with various, you know, senior people. And I tried looking up research and reading account, but I couldn't find anybody who'd done it like this. So I decided that I wanted to be there and that I would continue with my supervisor. I would stay with friends. When I was visiting, I traveled to be with friends, and I would live with the couple, and their family visited, and I had a separate room, and we had a business contract, and they paid for my travel. So I would come for a week at a time. I'd fly in, and then I'd go home. My patients in Santa Fe knew I was doing this difficult work and that they would have to deal with not having as much attention over the next couple of months. I didn't know how long. So it was not an easy decision, and I had very little to go by except my psyche and my supervision and my basic faith in the psyche, really.
How long did you end up living with them?
On and off for about 3 months.
Okay. And that's something that we haven't touched on here. This might be a good time to do it, is that working with this patient moved you into a different structure in terms of geography and timing and so on. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. You were part of the time you were in the Boston area, and the other part you were in New Mexico, and some of it was on the phone, which is mm-hmm. now very modern. But at that time, I don't think that was happening. So
it wasn't. After we started, we talked about, okay, when I move, what will we do? And I said, you always have the option for a referral, because I knew a couple of perfectly wonderful people for her here. I'm in Massachusetts. She was in Vermont. And that the plan was, after I moved to New Mexico, I would fly into the Boston area once a season for an intensive work week. And she would drive down, and I'd work with her intensively for a week at a time, and then have phone sessions between. This was before phone work was common. So we had had we didn't need to break the connection. And she was welcome to come to Santa Fe, but unfortunately, that didn't happen due to all kinds of things. But I knew she would have really enjoyed, you know, the art and the culture, et cetera. So some of this was kind of pioneering in a way. I mean, and I'm really glad I was in Santa Fe for 11 years because I learned a great deal. My mother was ill later, so I moved back to Massachusetts, I guess, 2005. So this feels more like home. I'm an ocean person, you know?
Yeah, me too.
It's a very different world in the high desert climate and tricultural area.
Yeah.
Visit. I still feel connected, so I visit. Yeah.
So. Yeah. Maybe we should visit that dream. You mentioned the last dream. And mm-hmm. so I'm going to have you read from your book.
Okay.
For those of you who are following along, after you rush out and get the book, it's page 116 is where we're going to start. And
this chapter is called Laura's Final Dream of the Analysis. And she had this after her diagnosis, right before we stopped our formal analysis. So it's the last one we really worked on together in a fresh way. So the dream comes after Laura's impossible few days, that is trying to integrate the diagnosis, which was terminal. After Laura's impossible few days, she has a dream of terrible devastation, which she shares with me in a phone session. I feel that this dream will be a message from her unconscious describing the devastation of her disease and her impending death. She writes it down in her dream notebook and makes a small pen drawing of a bone set with precious stones and wound with strong colored silk, threads of silk. She said she will send me a copy of the dream and the drawing in the mail. And she shares this. And when I hear it, I know she's preparing herself for the unknown. So here's the dream. I've come to the aftermath of terrible devastation, where people have experienced some great destruction, widespread loss of loved ones, an epidemic? I don't know if it's from war or disease. I think it is disease, because most of the mourners are men. I'm being shown what the men do to heal their suffering, and it's extraordinary. I think it must be Japan. Many of the men I visit are Japanese. They are all working with utmost care, carving and polishing the bones of their dead wives. The results are breathtakingly beautiful. I cannot speak when I see them. My eyes fill with tears and wonder. The men work silently, with reverence, as they smooth and polish, set precious stones in, and bind with strong colored threads of silk the bones of their loved ones. So I'll read a little bit, okay? So that was the dream. Upon hearing the dream, I'm astonished by the depths of beauty in this message from Lara's unconscious. I am moved in awe of Lara's psyche's attempt to help her absorb the reality of terrible destruction, devastation, great destruction, and it guides her toward mourning. Shaken by the powerful realities quickly unfolding, I'm trying to find my way in this new territory. Active dying has never been a part of my experience or analytic training. I take notes, writing down what I can as Lara tells the dream over the phone. At first, she talks about the dream as if it's about other people, another place, another time, not what's happening, not here and now happening to her. I stay with her trains of thought as she tries to make sense of the dream's meaning and to cope with her overwhelming feelings. She says, "The men in the dream are Japanese, survivors of war and disease, and survivors of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They have experienced truly catastrophic events and losses, yet their culture survives such unearthly devastation." Lara associates the dream to her familiar experience. Groups of Japanese men have come to our home many times for meetings to negotiate creative projects. I join them for many dinners and evenings of discussions ranging from the arts to the effects of the war. When I went to Japan with Jean, my husband, on business, I studied the extraordinary craftsmanship and attention to exquisite detail in the artwork. I feel that the Japanese men I knew could do what the dream is describing, ritual practices and putting their heart and spirit into their intricate arts. I think it is disease because most of the mourners are men. The dream is telling Lara that women, wives, have died from an unknown disease. Lara is being shown what the men do to heal their suffering. Her dream is assisting her with overwhelming realities and helping her prepare her husband for mourning. The dream is showing her something breathtakingly beautiful and extraordinary, evoking tears and wonder. The adjectives she's using are of grand scale, indicating the personal and a greater collective experience. The catastrophe, the grief, and the beauty are taking place in an exalted realm of experience, in the archetypal realm of the self. Lara is grieving through this dream and finding a way of acting in the face of annihilation through creativity and imagination. Grief work can be profoundly creative. It is important that the work be performed with reverence, thoughtfully, carefully, and with a spiritual sense. The artisan's handwork gives grief a personally felt, nonverbal form and a barely tolerable beauty.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. And she went on to, in the process of dying, she gathered friends and family. And there were rituals that kind of emerged, I guess, from the group and her husband. And so there was this circle, and you go through that process. You describe a lot of that process, and people might, thinking about their own mortality, they might find some good ideas there. How did this extended therapeutic relationship impact your own life, your own psyche? Just a little question. Big question, I know.
Well, it clearly changed me. I can remember one moment when I was sitting near the bed, I don't know how many days or weeks before her death, but I felt a belonging that was so extraordinary. You know, this wasn't really my family, but yet it was so incredibly human. There was something so connective about taking care of a member of the group, the tribe, the family, the world. And it broke through something for me. And I think my fears about death have, I mean, not that death isn't awesome, and I'm sure I'll go through many, many levels of feeling about it, but I felt less afraid, and I trusted approaching the mystery. And we don't always get a choice about how all this happens. This was, you know, really an extraordinarily graced experience for her and for me and for her family in the midst of this devastating loss. So I think I listened to the instruction of the dream. I'm not going to read more about it, but as you mentioned, those six stones on a cord, if you think about it, those stones that were set into the bones were precious. That is, stones, particularly carbon, under great pressure over time, can become rubies and emeralds and especially diamonds. And the thread was on the one level thread. On another level, it was silk that comes from spiders. Wow, where'd that come from? But came from silkworms. And her family, it turns out, had a silk factory in Connecticut years and years ago. So she had and she was a textile worker. So those threads were her personal history, her work history. Those threads are our genes. They are the thread of life in all of us, between us. So those threads that bind all this, you know, it actually moved me deeper into my own life. And I think I actually started writing this because I listened. I listened to it. And I'm a creative person. And I think this was my way of polishing, being with, and letting myself into a creative process. Who knew it would be 15 years of work on this? Who knew? Yeah. And I have become a writer in the process because art has always been my medium. And I learned to create a story and create images. This was a gift for me, and I pass it on. And I think grief can be paralyzing, but if really entered and valued, I think it's incredibly humanizing, and it is about compassion. Mm-hmm. And I think that connects us all, and it connects us to the earth and the cosmos. And I'm all for that.
Yeah. Good statement.
Yeah.
Well, you made reference to it, and I saw on your website that you've been involved in Stan Grof's holotropic breathing work. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, where does that fit in? What drew you to that? What are you getting out of it? I mean, you've already got all the degrees and certificates and trainings one would need. Where does this come in?
This is a really great story. Here are the threads that, you know, I'm talking about. I met Stan in 1972. I was in graduate school. I had one profound, incredibly life-changing LSD experience. I modeled it on the Good Friday experiment, if you read about the early work that was done. And I don't know how I heard about it, but Stan Grof was at Spring Grove State Hospital in Baltimore, associated with John Hopkins, doing LSD research with dying patients and alcoholics. There might have been more, but I remember that. So I went to meet him for an interview to be in that training program to be able to sit with people. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget the interview, which felt like it was hours. And
so this was pre-Laura, right?
It was 1972, yeah. And I didn't meet Laura till 1993. So 20 years ahead. So anyway, I was accepted by Stan to be in the training program and met his wonderful colleagues. And I felt like I was with people who understood the experience I'd been through with LSD. And as soon as I finished my master's in a few months and was ready for the training, the federal government shut down the research.
Yeah.
And I think it's now started up again, not with Stan, but with MAPS in California. Anyway. Yes. That's how my relationship with Stan Grof began. He went on studying all these, you know, world religions and spiritual experiences. He went on to incorporate mandala work. And eventually at Esalen, he added the breathing with his wife, Christina. And it all kind of came together. I, in the meantime, continued my art and human service and meditation. And I started studying Tibetan Buddhism in particular. And I started the Jungian work, series of dreams. I was thinking of taking a doctorate in Tibetan Buddhist studies and asked for a dream and had astonishing dreams that pretty much said, you should look at Jungian training. Huh. So I do want to say in 1989, after my Jungian training, I started to do breath work with Australian trained women that had to do with breath and nature and dolphins and whales. And I did that for a number of years and then came back eventually to work with Stan and finally commit to the training. So I'm not quite done. I still probably have another year to go, but I really love the breath work. And I do believe, actually, Stan had spoken to this person at an earlier time. So there was also that thread that was sort of mysteriously woven in. So many threads came together. Yeah. And Stan, I think, is a wonderful pioneer and teacher, and what a human being. And Tav Sparks, who's the director of the Grof Transpersonal Training, has been a dear, dear soul. I deeply respect what he's doing, and his wife, Carrie. And there are just a lot of wonderful people. I like the community. I like the training. I respect it. It's very different. Many people can't afford analytic work, whether it's a year or 5 years. They, you know, it's not going to happen. But the holotropic breath work can be a taste of something very profound. And we often need help integrating it with a therapist or friends or community. But it's a way of touching these archetypal transpersonal experiences in a relatively safe setting, and I respect that. Yeah. Lots of people won't do analytic work, but they may taste this. So it all comes together for me.
Sure. And I'm struck by the way that you were precognitively working with death and grief well before the experience of Laura arriving on your couch.
Yeah. Well, I didn't study with Dr. Kubler-Ross, but I met her and studied with one of her students, and I was in my 20s. I think my early experience, particularly with my father's descent, and he was very philosophical, I just felt, you know, very fortunate to have my imagination and my spiritual feelings supported, really, you know, traditional and non-traditional. So I guess I've always been kind of a pioneer of sorts, my quiet way.
Yeah. Well, I think this might be a good place for us to wrap it up, unless there's something that you want to say that we didn't get to.
I want to thank the many people who have supported me in my training and in my writing and even connecting me to you. You know, we don't do it alone. So I thank you for taking the time to talk to me. and read the book and to read my book. I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, me too. I can't always do that because I'm generally doing an interview a week, and sometimes I can only like a bee just or a hummingbird just suck out a little bit of the sweetness out of a book. But yours really compelled me to in there. So, yeah.
And I guess, you know, I have faith in the message of this story.
Yes.
And the last comment will be, Laura was an incredibly generous soul who wanted to share this so it might be helpful to others. And it was with her permission and her husband and Laura gave it. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, well, Penelope Tarasuk, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. Some time back, a psychologist friend and former guest on this show asked me why I was so interested in Jungian psychology, why I feature so many Jungian analysts in my interviews. Today's interview with Penelope Tarasuk is my answer to that question. I'm so impressed by her book. Maybe you can guess that I'm endorsing it strongly for all of you. I'm hoping that the quality of caring and presence that comes through so powerfully in her book has also come through in this interview. If you're only hearing this through the audio podcast, you might also want to check it out on my YouTube channel so that you can get the full visual of her delivery. She embodies all the qualities that draw me to the Jungian perspective. It's the honoring of the full story of what it is to be on this human journey. And as I like to say, it honors the mystery. Because I don't believe the full story is visible to us. So while I do honor science and believe science is a window to the truth, I don't think it's the only window or gives us the full picture. Now, it's true that polishing the bones is about pain and grief and ultimately death. I don't think you'll find it depressing, even though it deals with such heavy topics. I think it's likely that you'll find it uplifting and inspiring in a certain way, as I did. It's an affirmation of the strength and courage of analyst and patient meeting at a very deep level, and it's about an experience of the transcendent. I wanted to have Penelope read the passages that she did so that you could get a sample of the delicacy, beauty, and thoughtfulness of her writing. No wonder it took 15 years. You heard her reference to James Hillman. People don't come into treatment to fix what's broken. They really come to have what's broken blessed. Now, James Hillman died before I had a chance to interview him, but I did interview his wife of 20 years. If you haven't heard it, you might find it a good supplement to this interview. It's Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 391, James Hillman's Archetypal Psychology with Jungian analyst Patricia Berry. Penelope also made reference to her work with Stan Grof. I interviewed Stanislav Grof, MD, on transpersonal psychology and the meaning of psychedelic experience back in 2011 on my Wise Counsel podcast series. You can find a link to that series by clicking on the About Dr. Dave tab at shrinkwrapradio.com, and in the sixth paragraph down, you'll find a link to that series. Finally, if you decide to purchase Polishing the Bones by Dr. Penelope Tarasuk, you'll find a link to it specifically in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Josune, and I just had made a donation to your podcast, and it feels really good doing it. So it's something that I wanted to do for a long time. I have been listening to your podcast for the last couple of years. I have just graduated from clinical psychology, marriage family therapist, And while I was taking a break, I will download your podcast and go on a hike or my long commute. And I really enjoyed it. And it's been something that I really wanted to do, make a donation to, as a small gesture, to say thank you so much for all the good work that you do, Dr. Dave. And I wanted to encourage other listeners to do so, and so that you can keep doing what you do. So anyhow, thank you so much for the wonderful work that you do, and I encourage other listeners to do so. Thanks, Dr. Dave. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Josune, for that endorsement and for encouraging others to follow your fine example as we enter yet another year of podcasting. Last time, I told you I was planning to visit my old friend, Dwight Webb, in New Hampshire for around a week, and that I wasn't sure when I'd be able to get today's interview off to you. Well, I decided to postpone that trip due to the storms they were having back east, and so today's podcast went out according to my usual schedule. However, I don't have a guest lined up for next week yet, so I might end up skipping next week unless that changes soon. So until whenever that is, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Let us all remember, what you seek is what you find. Dr. Dave is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Exploring my spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind.
Been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.